I'm very grateful for the invitation to be here. Garrett and Julia, thank you for the organisation and everything here at the library. And for all of you for staying and still being here in the last session. So both Hamlet and Macbeth concern court politics of a usurping monarch, the consequences of their actions and the wish for revenge. In both cases, the king is murdered by the one who wishes to claim the throne, either King Hamlet by his brother Claudius or King Duncan by Macbeth, and the dead man's son and heir, Hamlet or Malcolm, seek vengeance. So it might therefore appear that the threats to the kingdom come from within, but both plays are also structured by external threats to the kingdom, to the integrity of the state. In Hamlet, this is Denmark's tension with Norway, the relation between both those countries and Poland, and more peripherally, links to England, France, and other parts of Europe. In Macbeth, it's Scotland's relations to Norway, England, and Ireland. And those wider stories are, especially in Hamlet, marginalised in most readings and productions. And it is tempting, of course, to concentrate on the internal politics of the Elsinore court, to focus on the familial relations. But Shakespeare provides a wider framing, and it seems to me that a number of plot elements become clearer if this is taken into account. So my focus on the regional is the international rather than the subnational, and geopolitics, although obviously an anachronistic term, for me is the earth and land politics that we find in this play. Now, the map we have here is one that Shakespeare would almost certainly have been familiar with from Ortelius's Theatrum Orbis Terrarum, and the places I've marked on there are the countries as they are today. The area of Poland at that time was occupied by Prussia, but you can see I've drawn in the blue, the roughly the boundaries between the states today, and the town there of Danzig, now of course modern day Gdansk. So the play outlines an extensive backstory in its opening scene, not just the death of King Hamlet and the quick marriage of his widow Gertrude to the brother Claudius, but also the wider conflict between Denmark and Norway a generation before. And the antagonism between these two countries had led to a battle in which King Hamlet had killed King Fortinbras. So both kings are now dead, and their namesake sons seek revenge. Hamlet over Claudius, Fortinbras over Denmark as a whole. Now, while Fortinbras is a minor figure in the dramatic action of the play, he's mentioned a few times and appears only briefly twice, he's in some sense the parallel and contrasting figure to Hamlet. Now, of course, most of you will know that with Hamlet there's also a crucial textual question in that there are three extant versions of the play. First quarto from 1603, usually dismissed as a bad quarto of about 2,100 lines, which may tell us something about how the text was performed, even if it's been printed in a corrupted version. The second quarto followed it into print very quickly, surviving examples from 1604 and 1605, and is a much longer text, almost twice the first quarto at 3,800 lines. And the first folio printed a still different text, frequently similar to the second quarto, but with hundreds of small changes, including about 80 lines not in the quarto and lacking about 200 that were. So while most modern editions begin with the second quarto, some begin with the folio, most of them conflate these sources in some way to provide a composite text and occasionally relegate a variant text to appendices or mark it up with brackets. And most stage productions tend to use a conflated text, although usually cut, although there are occasional performances of the first quarto alone. There was an interesting one in London just a couple of months ago. Now, for everything that I'm going to quote here, my general principle has been to follow the second quarto, but I've compared all of the passages to those other editions, and at certain times I'm going to mention those other editions because they're important to the argument that I'm making. The Arden series actually provides two volumes to give us those three texts, which has been helpful for the argument that I'm doing here and also some of the parallel text editions. But in terms of the secondary literature, perhaps the most important text for me has been Margherita de Grazia's Hamlet Without Hamlet, which seeks to decenter the psychological figure of Hamlet. And many of the insights that she proposes in that book are ones I'm trying to elaborate and develop here. So let me go back to the right to the beginning of the play. The members of the Night Watch encountering each other at the change of guard. And the cry goes out, "Who's there?" To which Horatio replies, "Friends to this ground." And Marcellus adds, "And liegemen to the Dane." So they're identifying themselves as people that have sworn to the land of Denmark, that is the country or the territory, and to its king. And it's important to recognise that throughout the play, when the term Denmark comes up, it can function as either a place or a person, both the land or the king. And sometimes that dual sense is clearly meant. The dead king, Hamlet's father, is sometimes referred to as Denmark, just as he is in the opening scene when the watch encounter the ghostly figure on the battlements. And Horatio addresses it, "What art thou that thus usurps this time of night, together with that fair and warlike form in which the majesty of buried Denmark did sometimes march?" And like much else, the first quarto is slightly different here. But whether usurping the knight or the state, this figure looks like the dead and buried king of Denmark, King Hamlet. Bernardo had earlier described the ghost as in the same figure, like the king that's dead. So they repeatedly stress, it looks like the king. It has the same shape and appearance as King Hamlet. But the idea that it might actually be the king seems obscured by something has usurped that body, perhaps an evil spirit. And of course, this now circles us back to Mary's paper on the first day with this question of the relation between the spirit and the body. Horatio then goes on to note further the visual resemblance the king has, or this figure has, to the king in his glory days. Such was the very armour he had on when he, the ambitious Norway, combated. So frowned he once when in an angry parle he smote the sledded poleaxe on the ice. Now there's some complexities in these short lines, Norway similarly referring to the king as much as the country. So we have a confrontation here between King Hamlet and the King of Norway, who we later hear is called Fortinbras. The first two lines of this second passage here describe that conflict. But do the next two lines continue that description, or do they refer to a different episode? The construction "when once" rather than "when then" seems to suggest two separate moments, but it is unclear. And this lack of differentiation is enhanced when we read the description of the second or the second part of the encounter. This is because sledded poleaxe, as it's spelt there, with AD and then a lowercase p in the first and the second quarto, or sledded double D, poleaxe with a capital P, as we find it in the folio, is ambiguous. Now, a poleaxe, as some texts amend it to, a sledded poleaxe or a sledded poleaxe, is of course a weapon. It's a long axe or a halberd. The spelling in the similar sense to how it appears in the quarto of P-O-L-A-X or P-O-L-L-A-X is used for this implement in Love's Labour's Lost, in the quarto and folio text respectively, the line being "your lion that holds his poleaxe sitting on a clothes stool." So it's clearly a figure holding a kind of weapon. So such a weapon would end in a sharp point, as here, like a pike, but it would have an axe at the end as an additional means of attack. If we read the text in this way, it leaves open the question of what sledded or sleeded, if you can hear the different spelling, would mean. And the most plausible explanation seems to be leaded or sledded, like a sledgehammer. So many weapons did indeed have that kind of counterweight on the other side, a hammer or some sort of studded implement on the other side to counterbalance the axe. Alternatively, sledded poleaxe can mean Polish people on sleds. These would be inhabitants of Poland, and at later points in the text, the Polak is used as a descriptive word for people from Poland. The Arden editors helpfully note here that Polak is not in this sense at the time derogatory, even if the word today, and especially here in North America, does have that negative connotation. Now, it's worth noting, and I've compared the different texts for the different spellings of this word, that where the first quarto refers to people from the place, which it does in two instances, the spelling is consistently ending in CK or CKE. And the second quarto has that, slight variance of that, several times. And then the folio spells it with a different EAK ending to it. Now, the other passages, they're the ones that are missing from that table, are ones where the corresponding passage does not appear in the different variants of the text. So it's worth noting that only for the sledded poleaxe do we have a spelling of any of these where it ends with a final X. Now, different editors interpret this in different ways. The Arden Third series, even though there are those three texts printed, unhelpfully renders it as sledded poleaxe, i.e. the people, in all three editions of their text. So they correct the other editions to correspond to the reading that they think is most important. Spencer's Penguin edition prefers the weapon, but the Oxford edition and the Cambridge First Quarto, the people. Now, despite what I've said there about the spelling, in some senses it seems to me that the Polish explanation seems best, that King Hamlet's military exploits are being outlined. First, a combat with Norway, and second, an angry Pal, turning the idea of a parley or a negotiation into a combat against the Poles. So two separate encounters. And given that Norway and Poland are later established as the major regional powers, there is a logic to this setting out of a three-way rivalry between them and Denmark at this early point. But while we hear no more of that possible particular encounter with Poland, the combat with Norway is outlined in some detail, and it has a very particular bearing on the construction of the play as a whole. Horatio says that the ghost, in the grope and scope of mine opinion, bodes some strange eruption to our state. And Marcellus asks him what the purpose of the military preparations is. As well as the watch, of which Horatio and his colleagues are part, brass cannon are being prepared and forced labour is being used in the shipyards. Horatio then is asked, can he explain the reason? That can I, at least the whisper goes so. Our last king, whose image even now but appeared to us, was, as you know, by Fortinbras of Norway, thereto pricked on by a most emulate pride, dared to the combat, of which our valiant Hamlet, for though this side of the world so esteemed him, did slay this Fortinbras, who by a sealed compact well ratified by law and heraldry, did forfeit with his life all these his lands, which he stood seized of to the conqueror, against the which a moiety competent was gauged by our king, which had returned to the inheritance of Fortinbras, had he been vanquisher, as by the same comart and carriage of the article design, his fell to Hamlet. I'll come back and talk through each of this parts in a moment. Now, sir, young Fortinbras, of unimproved metal hot and full, hath in the skirts of Norway here and there sharked up a list of lawless resolutes, for food and diet to some enterprise that hath a stomach in it, which is no other, as it doth well appear unto the state. But to recover of us by strong hand and terms compulsatory these foresaid lands so by his father lost. And this, I take it, is the main motive of our preparations, the source of this our watch, and the chief head of this post-haste and rummage in the land. Although that's a long quotation, it's an extremely compressed narrative. Horatio knows the story, but he recognises it as a whisper, perhaps a rumour or a secret. Hamlet, this is the title character's father, the murdered king, slay King Fortinbras of Norway after being provoked into combat through jealous rivalry. Hamlet, and this is the first time the dead king is named in the play rather than as Denmark, was known throughout the Western Hemisphere. Now, quite how Horatio knows how this dead king was dressed, the very armour he had on 30 years before, is of course unclear. But by his death, Fortinbras forfeited lands to Hamlet, which was an agreement sworn, legally just, and in accordance with the rules of chivalry. These lands of which he was in legal possession passed not to his son by inheritance, but to King Hamlet by conquest. Now, there's a debate about whether these lands were his personal lands or those of the kingdom, but it's clear that it was not the entirety of the kingdom, because the next line suggests the lands forfeited by Fortinbras had been balanced by a moiety competent, i.e. an equivalent portion of land, gauged or wagered by Hamlet. So had Hamlet fallen, these would have passed to Fortinbras, but as it was, Fortinbras' land went to Hamlet. Now, young Fortinbras, the dead king's son, refuses to accept this state of affairs, and we discover later that this combat happened on the very day of Hamlet's birth, young Hamlet's birth. Now, Fortinbras, wishing to prove himself, has roused in the borderlands, the outskirts of Norway, a group of men to form an army. Well, who are these men? Well, both the first and second quarto call them lawless resolutes, a group without law but resolved to some purpose. The folio, however, calls them landless resolutes, suggesting younger sons who did not inherit land and didn't, like Fortinbras himself, had not inherited land. Now, landless is a much less common word in Shakespeare than lawless. The only other instance of landless in Shakespeare appears in King John, used to describe the bastard, who, of course, had not inherited the lands through that confrontation with his brother in those opening scenes. So what we have landless resolutes, and not so much an army of criminals, but of disinherited gentry and younger sons. These are men, of course, much more likely to form a coherent army than some lawless renegades. Fortinbras, literally in French, strangely French for a Norwegian king, but literally in French would mean strong in arm, now with a strong hand, is threatening to recover the lands his father had lost a generation before. And it's for this purpose that Horatio and his colleagues keep watch, because of the threats to the state of Denmark. So Fortinbras is the cause of the disturbance, the urgency, the post-haste and rummage, and therefore the reason for the watch and the military preparations. Now, this lawless or landless resolute is interesting in relation to a later episode in the play. This is when Hamlet and Horatio encounter the gravedigger who's throwing the skulls out of the grave. Now, one of those skulls, of course, is very famous, but the others, I think, are interesting too, because Hamlet says these might be the skulls of Cain, a politician, a courtier, and then a lawyer. Well, there's another. May it not be the skull of a lawyer? Where be his quiddities now, his quillets, his cases, his tenures, and his tricks? Why does he suffer this mad knave now to stop, knock him about the sconce with a dirty shovel and will not tell him of his action of battery? This fellow might be in his time a great buyer of land, with his statutes, his recognizances, his fines, his double vouchers, his recoveries. Is this the fine of his fines and the recovery of his recoveries, to have his fine pate full of fine dirt? Will vouchers vouch him no more of his purchases and doubles than the length and breadth of a pair of indentures? The very conveyances of his land will hardly lie in this box, and must the inheritor himself have no more. Huh? So what do we have here? We have this transition, in a sense, from a lawyer suing the gravedigger for assaulting his head with a spade to the legal quibbles or niceties of arguments, and then moving to a set of terms relating to legal property over land, the conveyance ultimately being a document so large that it would not fit in the grave. Quiddities are excessive, subtle, scholastic arguments concerning the quiditas, or essence, of a thing. But quillets are both verbal quibbles and also small pieces of land. And that double meaning of quillets thus nicely captures this legal land issue. Tenures are, of course, titles to land and other property, and tricks suggests sharp practices, while Law Tricks was the title of a 1604 play by John Day. As the editors of the Arden series note, Thompson and Taylor, Hamlet here is using legal terminology relating to transactions in land. Statutes were securities for debts and mortgages. Recognizances were bonds relating to debts. Fines and recoveries were legal fictions used in the conveyancing, i.e. the legal transfer of ownership of land. Vouchers and double vouchers were ways of securing third parties as guarantors. And recoveries were suits for obtaining possession. The pair of indentures, like the indentures tripartite of the map scene in Henry IV, Part 1, would be sealed by both parties, and perhaps these would be on the same sheet of paper, cut in such a way that those two parts or three parts, and only those, could be put back together as a means of preventing forgery. But this lawyer has not just purchased land for others, but for himself too, perhaps implied by his purchases. As a purchaser, he's not, of course, strictly speaking, an inheritor, and this is perhaps why there's so complicated a legal set of terms, that the documents are so extensive they'll not fit in this small patch of burial ground. Now, as many people have suggested, Hamlet's interest in property and inheritance, of course, relate to his own position as a disinherited son, and that nature of his disinheritance is reinforced by the case of Fortinbras, this kind of parallel story. Although Hamlet, of course, has been unjustly robbed of land, whereas we're told, at least by Danish sources, that Fortinbras' father lost it by a sealed compact well ratified by law and heraldry. If we return back to the opening of the play in the second scene, we discover why Fortinbras has chosen this specific moment to threaten Denmark and try and get those lands back. King Claudius notes his brother's death, although, of course, he doesn't explain it. And the succession, or the instability of the succession, has apparently meant that Fortinbras feels the state is vulnerable. So Claudius notes, "Now follows that you know young Fortinbras, holding a weak supposal of our worth, or thinking by our late dear brother's death, our state to be disjoint and out of frame, colleagued with the dream of his advantage, he hath not failed to pester us with message, importing the surrender of those lands lost by his father, with all bands of law, to our most valiant brother." So this, of course, reinforces Horatio's narrative, notably stressing here the bands of law concerning the lost lands. And it adds that Fortinbras is now thinking that Denmark is militarily weak, and so he's made a demand for the return of the land. Claudius is dismissive of Fortinbras, but he wants to make sure, which is why he sends his ambassadors to Norway. So much for him. Now for ourselves and for this time of meeting, thus much the business is. We have here writ to Norway, uncle of young Fortinbras, who, impotent and bedrid, scarcely hears of this his nephew's purpose, to suppress his further gate herein, in that the levies, the lists, and full proportions are all made out of his subject, and we here dispatch you, good Cornelius, and you, Voltemund, for bearers of this greeting to old Norway, giving to you no further personal power of business with the king, more than the scope of these delated articles allow. Farewell, and let your haste commend your duty. So we find out here that in Norway, just as in Denmark, it was the dead king's brother rather than his son that had succeeded him to the throne. Now in Norway this makes sense. Young Fortinbras could only have been a child at the moment that his father died, although in Denmark, of course, the succession was very much open to question. The contrast between old Norway and Claudius is clearly stark. One is bedridden and impotent, the other newly married. Claudius, though, wants to take no chances, and he wants to get Norway to reign in his nephew, much as he wishes, of course, to reign in his own nephew. Diplomatic means, rather than threat of force, are then used by sending these ambassadors to deflect the Norwegian invasion. And the parallels between the generations are also clear. King Hamlet was clearly spurred to action, while his son will hesitate in the play to come. King Fortinbras was a noble opponent, but young Fortinbras operates in a different and, it seems, less honourable way. And as Spencer notes in the Oxford edition, the personal combat between the kings Hamlet and King Fortinbras seems to belong to a different and older world from that of King Claudius, who is a modern politician working through ambassadors. Now, these ambassadors return in Act 2 bearing a message from Norway. Voltemund reports, "Most fair return of greetings and desires. Upon our first, he sent out to suppress his nephew's levies, which to him appeared to be preparation against the Polak. But better looked into, he truly found it was against your highness, whereat grieved that so his sickness, age, and impotence was falsely borne in hand, sends out arrests on Fortinbras, which he, in brief, obeys, receives rebuke from Norway, and in fine, makes vow before his uncle nevermore to give the assay of arms against your majesty. Whereon old Norway, overcome with joy, gives him 3,000 crowns in annual fee, and his commission to employ those soldiers so levied, as before, against the Polak, with an entreaty herein further shown, that it might please you to give quiet pass through your dominions for this enterprise on such regards of safety and allowance are therein set down." Largely clear, I think. Norway, when alerted to Claudius' concerns, discovers the army he thought was headed for Poland was actually a threat to Denmark. He orders Fortinbras to cease. He gets him to swear he won't attack Claudius and his state. Norway rewards Fortinbras with an annual allowance and sends him to attack the Poles. Voltemund then produces a document that allows Fortinbras to be allowed safe passage through Danish lands to make that attack possible. Clearly a much more cautious and deferential attitude of a sort of legal treaty. And it's a claim that Claudius seems pleased to accept. Now we hear no more of Fortinbras until Act 4, when he appears at the head of an army and sends a messenger to the Danish king, actually claiming this rite of passage. In the second quarto and the folio, he says, "Go, captain, from me greet the Danish king. Tell him that by his license Fortinbras craves," folio has claims, "the conveyance of a promised march over his kingdom. You know the rendezvous. If that his majesty with aught with us, we shall express our duty in his eye and let him know so." So that agreement between Denmark and Norway, allowing for the passage of Norway's forces, is being called into use at this moment. Although Fortinbras wishes to inform Denmark of this rather than simply to do it. But if the king wishes, he will meet him face to face, that rather aggressive term of in his eye. So there's a politeness to the words, but there's clearly a veiled threat. In the quarto he craves, in the folio he claims, something that has been agreed. Now as the captain leaves, in the first quarto the scene ends, but in the other two texts Fortinbras instructs his army to go either softly on, in the second quarto, or safely on, in the folio. So either with respect, or safe in the knowledge that they will not be challenged, Fortinbras and his army exit. Now, in the second quarto, but only in that edition of the text, Hamlet encounters this army as he leaves for England. He meets the captain as he leaves to do Fortinbras' bidding, and he asks, whose powers are these? Now, the dialogue establishes that they are Norway's, commanded by Fortinbras, and directed against some part of Poland. Hamlet asks, goes it against the main of Poland, sir, or some frontier? Now, the main is probably the mainland, although it might actually be the coast. Frontier may either be the frontier as in a border or an extremity, but it may actually be a fortress on the frontier, and that's actually the meaning that the Oxford English Dictionary gives, and gives this as the earliest use of frontier, meaning a frontier fortress. And the captain replies to this question when Hamlet asks him where it's actually going to attack. He says, truly to speak, and with no little addition, we go to gain a little patch of ground that hath in it no profit but the name. To pay 5 ducats, 5, I would not farm it, nor will it yield to Norway or the Pole a ranker rate should it be sold in fee. So the captain, perhaps he's even a farmer in civilian or in an earlier life, although farm may actually mean to rent or lease out, sees the target as little more than a vanity conquest. Neither the king of Norway nor of Poland will gain much if they were to sell it or to farm it. While Hamlet thinks that the Polack will not defend it, the captain notes that it is already garrisoned by a defending army, so much seems to be at stake in its possession. And Hamlet notes that the men that will fight over this plot of land, what he calls this straw, a trivial or a worthless thing, he says this plot of land is not even big enough to bury the dead from the contest over it. It's not tomb enough and consonant to hide the slain. Now, there's a soliloquy that follows this by Hamlet where he says, you know, he's seen that Fortinbras is acting in this resolute way and that from this time forth, he says, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth. And some editors have suggested that clearly this scene was written in order to give occasion for Hamlet to give that soliloquy, although that seems to me to miss the importance of this geopolitical frame to this wider story. Now, Fortinbras, of course, doesn't appear again in the play until the final scene, where shortly before his death from Laertes' cuts and Claudius' poison, Hamlet hears a commotion without and exclaims, what warlike noise is this? The courtier Osric replies, young Fortinbras with conquest comes from Poland, yeah, he's returning, and to the ambassadors of England gives this warlike volley. And Fortinbras then enters at the head of an army after the Polack Wars alongside the English ambassadors. And they meet, of course, in this final scene of carnage with the king, queen, Hamlet and Laertes all dead. Almost every other claimant to the Danish throne is deceased. And so two wider elements of what I'm calling the geopolitical plot of the play coincide. Fortinbras' victory in Poland, but also the English messengers returning with the news that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. And Hamlet's words concern both England and also the succession. Oh, I die, Horatio. The potent poison quite o'crowds my spirit. I cannot live to hear the news from England, but I do prophesy the election lights on Fortinbras. He has my dying voice. So tell him with the occurrence more and less which have solicited. The rest is silent. So young Hamlet, born on the day that old Fortinbras died at the hands of King Hamlet, thus gives his voice or his vote to young Fortinbras. Fortinbras will be crowned King of Denmark unopposed in the wake of the deaths of all of the other contenders. And Fortinbras, of course, remarks, such a sight as this becomes the field, the battlefield, but here shows much amiss. And the English ambassadors are not even sure who they should deliver their message to, that the king's commandment, at least as they understood it, has been fulfilled, that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. Fortinbras assumes his authority by military might and presumed right of succession. For me, with sorrow, I embrace my fortune. I have some rights of memory in this kingdom, which now to claim my vantage doth invite me. So Fortinbras, therefore, encircles the play. His preparations against Denmark created the need for the night watch in the opening scene. His arrival to take the crown ends it. The lands lost by his father are reclaimed. The lands won by Hamlet's father are seized. Denmark becomes a territory under Norwegian dominion. Now, while Denmark, Norway and Poland are the three crucial countries in what I'm calling here the regional geopolitics of the play, there's other places that are also important. I've said a little bit about some of those. The very beginning of the play, we hear that Hamlet has returned from university in Wittenberg in Saxony, and so for him the death of the father and the marriage of the mother and uncle are compressed in the narrative even more than their actual temporal proximity.
As he says, the funeral baked meats did coldly furnish forth the marriage tables. Hamlet clearly expects to return to Wittenberg, but he's not allowed to by his uncle. And in contrast, Laertes, Ophelia's brother, requests that the king allows him to leave the court to return to France. Later, though, when Laertes' father, Polonius, is dead, Laertes comes back from France and, at least in the second quarto in folio, foments an uprising against Claudius. The king learns that Laertes has in secret come from France, and he appears within moments at the head of a large crowd of followers in a riotous head that is leading a rebellion. Indeed, the crowd call him Lord and say Laertes shall be king. Claudius, of course, is able to turn Laertes against, changing him from challenging him to challenging Hamlet, because he says that Hamlet is the one that is responsible for his father's death. And that's an enmity reinforced when Laertes meets the spurned and now mad Ophelia. So we now have three main characters, male characters, all seeking to avenge their father's deaths. And Hamlet seems to acknowledge this in Laertes, at least in the folio, when he says, "For by the image of my cause I see the portraiture of his." But both Laertes and Fortinbras, of course, are much more active in seeking the vengeance. Now, I already mentioned that Hamlet encounters Fortinbras when he's on his way to England, and the grave scene is when he's on his way back from England. Now, he's heading to England initially on the orders of the king. This was proposed in the first place as a cure for his madness, but also that he could be useful to Denmark. He shall with speed to England for the demand of our neglected tribute. This is probably the Danegeld, the money that England would pay to Denmark in the early 11th century to prevent Viking invasions of the island. And this hints then clearly at a historical relation between England and Denmark, but one that's largely unexplained in the text. But as things develop after the play within the play, England's debt doubles as a means of getting Hamlet out of the way, because Claudius realises that Hamlet is a threat to him and wants him dead. He uses Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to achieve this. "I like him not, nor it stands safe with us to let his madness range. Therefore prepare you. I your commission with will forthwith dispatch, and he to England shall along with you. The terms of our estate may not endure, hazard so near us as doth the hour grow out of his brows." And again, there's variance in the folio. But Claudius, the most important thing for me in this, is that he wants to preserve the terms of our estate, i.e. his position or status as king, but also the lands that he has achieved by becoming king. And after the killing of Polonius, Hamlet seems to embrace this departure. He makes those repeated calls of for England in Act 4. But Claudius now has a very different purpose. "And England, if my love thou holds at aught, as my great power thereof may give thee sense, since yet the cicatrice looks raw and red after the Danish sword, and thy freely oar pays homage to us, thou mayst not coldly set our sovereign process, which imports at full by letters conquering to that effect, the present death of Hamlet. Do it, England, for like the hectic in my blood he rages, and thou must cure me, till I know 'tis done, howe'er my haps my joys will ne'er begin." So it appears that Denmark has inflicted some kind of victory over England recently, scarring it with the cicatrice from the Danish sword. Claudius believes that this will make England do his purpose, his sovereign process, commanding the death of Hamlet to cure him of the illness caused by his presence. So England here, as with Denmark and Norway earlier, means both the king and the country. And Hamlet, of course, discovers this plot when he finds the document. He says, "A grand command, speaking of royal knavery, an exact command, my head should be struck off." And Hamlet, of course, switches that instruction for one that commands the killing of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern instead. Now, much of what I've talked about here, particularly the Fortinbras story, is frequently dropped in stage and film adaptations. But my suggestion is that it's actually crucial to the geopolitics or the territorial aspects of the play. The play is often read and performed in such a way as to focus on the internal struggle, internal to Hamlet, but internal to Denmark. It becomes effectively a personal or a family tragedy. And one of the exceptions of this in terms of a film adaptation is Kenneth Branagh's film, where you have that moment where they've all been inside this building and running around in this rather claustrophobic space, and then it goes full widescreen when Hamlet encounters Fortinbras' army. And The Branner adaptation was criticised for including that and distracting from the particular plot that people tend to focus on. But Linda Chans, I think, has got a good response to this. She says, from the perspective of producing a tight film, this view might make sense, were it not for one inescapable fact. Fortinbras' invasion is anything but superfluous. Shakespeare begins and ends the play with the problem of Norway's claims, and an Elizabethan audience, worried about English succession in the last years of Elizabeth's life, would have considered the threat to Denmark as a nation at least as important as Hamlet's state of mind. And indeed, it seems to me that it actually adds to the claustrophobic nature of the majority of the play's action, the family drama, the personal philosophical struggle, by having this larger frame around it. The struggles between King Hamlet, Claudius, and young Hamlet, past, present, and putatively future kings, operating in a single space, but larger geopolitical forces are operating around them. Denmark is revealed to be a small plot of land surrounded by dangerous enemies, reduced to being a passage route from Norway to Poland, which is the price of its protection from Norway itself. At least some of the land of the Danish court had been gained by Norway's death, but it was only a moiety of his lands and power. And eventually the internal feuding opens up the possibility for Fortinbras to walk into the court unopposed, to be elected by Hamlet in his dying words. Now, several of these geopolitical speeches are made by Horatio, and many of the others are made to him, or at least in his presence. Hamlet himself is often not present when some of this backstory is outlined, particularly in the opening scenes on the battlement. And it's interesting, I think, that Horatio is one of only a couple of characters, Hamlet himself and the Queen, who cannot be doubled in the play. Even though Horatio is absent from the stage from the whole of Act 2, the second half of Act 3 and the first half of Act 4, his presence on the stage at the same time as others means he could only conceivably double Reinaldo or the Norwegian captain, hardly major parts. For Hamlet, Horatio is a trusted friend, a link back to Wittenberg, but also an important member of the Night Watch and of the court. He's the key figure to whom Hamlet expresses his political concerns. And as Hamlet says to Horatio in an early scene, in a passage that's only in the second quarto, the celebrations of Claudius following the wedding denigrate Denmark's position in the world. He says, this heavy-handed revel east and west makes us traduced and taxed of other nations. And one line in that speech nicely captures for me what I call the geopolitics of the personal. The Danish reputation for drunkenness can be seen as oft breaking down the pales and forts of reason. Now, the pales, of course, are the fortifications or defences around an enclosed space or a park, while fortresses, of course, are part of that military strategy. But as well as the military threat, this is a speech that's given on the battlements just before the first appearance of the ghost to Hamlet, it also hints at the fragility of mental states. And perhaps Horatio's otherwise deeply connected nature is why, rather strangely, in the grave scene, Hamlet has to tell him who Laertes is, because the two characters had not actually met on stage until that moment. Now, despite some misgivings I have about his work generally, Franco Moretti's network analysis of the plot is useful here. He makes the case that Horatio offers a pivotal role in the connections between characters, and he draws this connection of speeches that take place between characters, and Hamlet, of course, is at the core of that network. But Claudius and Horatio are not far behind, so the red connections there, all the characters that Hamlet speaks to, the blue, all that Claudius speaks to, but Horatio there also has a network around him. What's interesting is when Moretti takes Hamlet out of the network, then two other clusters of connection become extremely clear. First, the court around Claudius, but second, the other figures in the play. And besides Hamlet, it's only Horatio that keeps them in touch. And if you were to remove Horatio from there, that network of all of those other figures would also completely collapse around it. So that Moretti is effectively suggesting that something quite interesting is happening around this figure of Horatio. And Thompson and Taylor in the Arden edition characterise this network of ambassadors, messengers, sentinels as being almost a bureaucratic, impersonal network that Horatio is in a sense heralding a new political reality that's emerging at the time Shakespeare is writing, the replacement of the court by the state. Now, it's certainly possible to imagine Hamlet the play without the Fortinbras subplot, and stage versions that I've seen have certainly attempted to do so. Hamlet's personal issues with the death of his father, his mother's marriage to his uncle, and his uncle's role as murderer, well, these could all remain without the need for a backstory of King Hamlet's battle with King Fortinbras. And stage productions get into a problem with this if they marginalise that too much, because who is this figure Fortinbras when he appears on the stage in the final scene? It would need then some explanation. But the ambassadors might be removed. Hamlet doesn't need to encounter the Norwegian army. Indeed, he doesn't in the first quarto or the folio. And the description of the ghost doesn't need to have the whole historical narrative attached to it. The play, I think, would lose a lot, but it would not collapse. But with Macbeth, I think things are somewhat different. The play, if it didn't have the external threat of Norway at the beginning of Macbeth and the traitorous elements that join with Norway, how would Macbeth prove himself and how would the position of Thane of Cawdor become vacant? Without Malcolm's flights to England, the establishment there of a base for rebels such as Macduff to fly to, and the support of the English king and Siward, Lord of Northumberland, how would Macbeth be overthrown? Of course, the play could be rewritten to avoid those external elements, but it couldn't simply be cut to do so. But paradoxically, Hamlet has much more detail about the external politics than Macbeth. In Macbeth, just about enough is said to situate the story, but in Hamlet, as in so many other aspects of the play, the wider picture is filled out in a much fuller way. And this may, of course, be down to the fact that Macbeth that we have is probably a cut version of an original text. But the both plays seem to me to demonstrate the regional geopolitics within which the stories are set, with the vulnerability of small kingdoms at threat, not just at home, but also abroad. Thank you.